In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about SaaS marketing from square one. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 381. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us. The podcast helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product, you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
You know, I had never realized that we say startups for the rest of us three times in the introduction.
Yeah, I kind of stumble over it a little bit sometimes. I think you do
as
well.
It's a long title. Yeah, I know. We should think about changing that. But aside from that, things are actually going really well this week. As you know, I mentioned on the show before, Sherry and I have put together a book called The Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together. Sherry was very much the first author and the driving force behind this. And I contributed topics, stories, anecdotes. I did some of the writing, but for the most part, it was Sherry writing. But it's super stoked to have it out, man. It's launched on Wednesday of last week. And so far, sales have been good. We're going with an all Amazon approach, which is interesting. It's something I haven't done before. And so, you know, it's a trip because like you don't get your customer email addresses, but the one-click buy makes it so much easier for people to kind of buy versus, you know, coming to your website and entering credit card info into a Stripe form or whatever. So far, two thumbs up. I think Sherry's learning a ton. I've obviously been offering advice and, you know, helping draft emails and, you know, put the wrong link in the launch email. That was me in my own software. Oh, I sent it through Drip and I told Sherry, if it's a bug in Drip or it's my copy-paste error, I'm still screwed. I can't even blame it on anybody, you know? Like, it's my fault. It wasn't a bug and drip. I just made a copy-paste error and left the H off, the HTTP for the book link. So I had to resend a correction, which I pretty much have never done ever in my launch career. Like, I always triple-check stuff, and I was just in too much of a hurry, so...
That's funny. You know, I was actually going to accuse you of writing only one line in the entire book. And it was like the little anecdote where it says, you know, Rob's thoughts. And then there was no, and then end Rob.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote that. I also wrote a bunch of the stories in there. And yeah, it was a fun project. And it was, you know, what was fun about it for me was being able to kind of contribute, almost like I did more than just consult on it, but to read drafts and to edit and to help shape things, but to not have it was not the full burden. You know, I wasn't the founder on this one, right? I was more like the, you know, board member or advisor or something. So that's kind of cool. And then it's also fun to see someone launch a product like this at this scale for the first time. Because, you know, you feel vulnerable, you're excited, but you're not sure what to do, and you're just kind of stumbling along. And, you know, I could just see all this stuff shaping up as she's gone through the process.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's nerve-wracking for her, too. I mean, when you first put something out there, especially with a book where it's got, I think with software, there's like that layer of abstraction of like, oh, yeah, you created this, but you're kind of in the background, and the software is kind of the thing that people are seeing. But I think with a book, you're kind of putting your expertise out there as well, and that can be a little nerve-wracking, especially because you're not sure how it's going to be received, or like, did you hit on the right pain points that people have, and are they really the things that people are feeling? Not that you're not confident, it's just that, you know, there's a difference between a smaller subset of people that you've actively worked with versus a much larger set, especially when you don't know who those people are.
Totally. It's always just vulnerable and kind of, I think vulnerable is the right word, you know, when you throw something out and you know, thousands of people in essence are gonna wind up buying this book here. And it's, you know, hopefully most of them read it. And so you just have to kind of be prepared for thoughts and comments, and they'll be both positive and, you know, as well as critiques. And I think it's just a lot to put yourself out there, you know, whether it is with software or a book.
Yeah, I'm very glad that I got both the paperback version and the Kindle version, because I kind of had to, you know, fight my wife off for the book because she saw it and she took it.
Oh, that's funny. Cool. Glad to hear it.
Yep. So anyway, yeah, we went through that over the weekend. So it's a good read. I liked it. It was very
Yeah, good. I was going to ask what you thought of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it touches on a lot of topics that have not been well talked about, but they're starting to, and I think that Sherry's probably a very big contributing factor to that just based on her talks at MicroConf and how well they've been received. But I think it's a topic of discussion that people are a little bit more comfortable discussing now than they were 5 years or 10 years ago. And it's nice to have it now, but I almost wish it was out there like 10 years ago, you know?
Yeah, I know. I wish I had this book when I started. And you know, if you don't know what this book is about, it's about how to run your business without letting it run you. So it's how not to spin out of control and be super stressed out, and how to know yourself more, how not to burn your relationships, how to stay human, how to stay connected to people. It's really, it's kind of, she calls it like founder mental health, but I always think of that as like, I don't know, if I'm not depressed or I don't have an anxiety disorder, then I don't need it. But it's not that. It's just how to fight through and really stay sane and maintain solid relationships and not piss off your wife and your kids and neglect your family and gain a bunch of weight and go crazy. And, you know, I mean, I was so freaking stressed running drip and selling drip. Like, I wish that I had, you know, again, a resource like this. So that sounds like you, or you think you might be encountering that anytime soon. You can search on Amazon. There's a Kindle and a paperback version, Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together. And we'll link it up in the show notes for sure. And Sherry recorded an audio version and has submitted it to Audible, but it is not approved yet. So I'll probably talk about that once it's approved as well.
Very cool. Well, I'm in the middle of working on my FemtoConf talk, and it'll probably be something of a preview of my MicroConf talk, to be honest. So it's nice to be getting that much of a jump start on it. I don't think that usually I start on my talks until probably a month or so before the conference. And, you know, it's like 2.5-3 months out at this point. So it'll be nice to get that done in advance and then kind of give a preview of it and see what resonates and what doesn't and be able to go through it a few times in addition, like before a live audience, as opposed to just getting up there and kind of giving it, you know, in front of a live audience for the first time at MicroConf.
Yeah, I could see that. It's really nice to be able to give a talk twice. I always give a talk better, almost always give it better the second time.
Yep. And then the other thing is paper spiders. If you enjoy pranks of any kind, go into the bathroom and on the other side of the toilet paper roll, draw a giant black spider and then put it back so you can't see it.
Really? Even though it's just drawn, people will like...
Well, because you don't see it until you flip the roll over, so...
Nice. Where did you hear about this?
Well, I saw it online, but I practiced it yesterday and my son was not pleased.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Cool. What are we talking about today?
Well, today we're going to be talking about SaaS marketing from square one. And this actually comes to us as a, sort of a listener question I'd put out on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, asking if there were any topics specifically that people wanted to hear about. And one of them was from Philip, who asked how to start a product from scratch after my MVP is ready, because growth hacks are everywhere, but nobody talks about starting marketing from a blank page, i.e. no social media, no newsletter recipients, no SEO, nothing, zero traffic. So I thought we would go through this and talk through kind of some ideas around where you would even start with that. So at the very base level, you've got an MVP, which, I mean, we've talked about this kind of extensively. If you haven't done marketing before you get to this point where you've got a product to put out there, then you've done things wrong. But I also feel like we just get a number of questions that are around this where people have already made that mistake and it's too late to change it. So now what do I do? So we're going to talk through kind of where you start, different types of channels you can use, and strategies to put the product out there and try to make it into a success, even if you haven't started doing any of the marketing beforehand.
Sounds good. I know this is a common question, and it's something that over time, you know, if you listen back to previous episodes, and if you look in both of our books, Start Small, Stay Small, The Single Founder Handbook, or even blog posts, I mean, this is just such a common topic that we've covered, but it's worth revisiting every so often and kind of trying to see if there's either new information or just to revisit for all of our edification, you know, and a reminder for all of us.
So the first question to ask is, where do you even start? And I think that in a situation like this, you kind of need to work a little bit backwards. The first thing to look at is knowing what your timeline and your runway look like. And by this, I mean, really, what date is it that you need to be making X dollars in MRR, whether it's $5,000 a month or $10,000 a month? You know, how much money is it that you're spending on a monthly basis? How much do you need to leave your job? How much money do you need to recover in order to pay back a particular loan or something like that? What are the hard deadlines that you have set to you that you need to be conscious of? And then based on those things, what are the current pricing plans that you have? How many customers would you need in order to be able to meet whatever that MRR goal is? And establishing this timeline really does two things for you. The first one is that it provides you with a required trajectory. How many customers do you need to add on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis in order to get there? And the second thing that this does is it helps you to eliminate certain types of marketing channels. Because if you have a really short timeline, some longer-term marketing channels are simply not going to work for you. So you can completely throw them out the window and focus on other things that are shorter. And they may not be repeatable or sustainable, but they will help get you to where you need to be.
Yeah, I like the idea of this one. And I think that as you get more experience, let's say it's your second or third app or second or third kind of success, I think you can get really good at determining these timelines of the build timelines, you know, of actually building the product and then kind of ramping up marketing and taking a half-assed guess at it. I remember the doc I put together for Hittail, it was like the marketing game plan. It wound up being somewhat accurate, but I wasn't as experienced as I was when we launched Drip in 2013. And that doc, I put together this whole analysis of like how many uniques I thought I could drive to the site each month, how many would convert to trial, how many would convert to paid, what the growth would look like. And I mapped it out and it wound up being shockingly accurate. And the only thing that killed us was we didn't have product market fit yet. And so I underestimated churn, right? And when you don't have product market fit, your churn can be 20%, 25%. So you lose a lot more people. If churn had been closer to what I thought, the growth would have been very, very much in line with what I was guessing at. The one issue I have with this, or the thing that I think could be hard, is if this is literally your first time, you don't know any of the rules of thumb, right? You don't know, hey, if I ask for credit card up front, I'm going to get between 0.5 and 2% of visitors to convert to trial, depending on how appealing my site is, what the price point is, and all that. And you don't know if you're asking for credit card up front, you should convert between 40 and 60% of trials to paid users. And then your churn should be pretty high in the first 2 months and then drop down. You know, it's just all that stuff you can either learn from experience or you can listen to podcasts like this. When we had Ruben Gomez on the show, it's probably 50 to 100 episodes ago, he and I threw out a bunch of rules of thumb exactly around this. And it's towards the end of that episode, if you want to go back and listen to it. And I've also put it in my MicroConf talk either last year or the year before. I just had one slide, kind of the rules of thumb things I use to do it. But I like the idea of asking, where do you need to get to? Because, you know, this is something investors would ask you if you took them. And so if you're not taking investment, it is nice to think about where you're going and not just, you know, kind of go out and just kind of, I guess, wander. I feel like, you know, if you don't know where you're going, how do you know how to get there?
Yeah, and that kind of introduces the idea of like having a fudge factor and the timeline that you can put together based on your pricing plans and how many customers you need and the timeline. Like, that's a best case scenario. You're going to have to go over that. So let's say that you need, I don't know, 200 customers in order to get to 10,000 a month. How many do you realistically need to shoot for? Is it 200? Probably not, because you're going to have people who sign up and then decide that they are not going to become customers, or they go through a trial and they say, this isn't for me, or they just never even set up the software or set up their account and do anything with it. And there's lots of people who kind of fall into that category. So, you know, you have to overshoot by some margin, but at the same time, you need a starting point of some kind. And the simple calculation of your timeline, runway, and number of customers is going to at least help put you in the right ballpark. And that's really what you're looking for, is like, how do I get in the right ballpark? How do I get started on the right path versus I'm not going to do anything because I don't even know where to start. So the next step is, once you've got that information in mind, the next thing to do is to break out your plan of attack into the different types of marketing channels that you're going to go after. And these aren't specifically marketing channels. You probably find in a book that it would say, okay, these are all encompassing. These are two that I thought would apply specifically to this type of situation. And the first pair of marketing channels is sustainable versus unsustainable. It's really just a broad categorization of the different types of marketing approaches you might try. And then the second one is inbound versus outbound efforts. And there's lots of other different ways to categorize or classify different marketing efforts, but let's just kind of focus on these two pair. And sustainable versus unsustainable, the way I really put these into perspective or talk about these is, with sustainable, it requires some sort of systematic repetition over time. It's usually harder to get going, but they tend to have a longer life to them. And some examples of this would be things like SEO, content marketing, blogging, email newsletters, video channels on YouTube, paid acquisition, etc. And then with unsustainable marketing channels, these tend to be one-time or burstable activities. So if it's one-time, typically you can do it once and then that's it. So an example of something like that would be listing your website on Product Hunt. Now, you could do that once, but the chances of you being able to do that more than once for the same application are probably pretty slim. You can come out with new features or subsets of things that you could add on there, but they tend to be things that you're not going to do for a while. And then there's burstable activities, like doing a podcast tour. You're probably not going to go on the same podcast over and over again, but you could go to multiple podcasts and do like a podcast tour. You could answer a bunch of questions on Quora. You could do joint webinars with other people. You could do integration marketing. Again, that's an example of something that you would be able to do one time, but you're not going to integrate with Calendly more than once, for example. So those are the types of sustainable versus unsustainable activities that I would look at, and I would classify your marketing activities as one of the two. And that kind of leads us down the road into the inbound versus outbound.
Yeah, some of the sustainable channels you mentioned require, or most of them require ongoing work, but they're like a flywheel, right? Where they're this big, heavy wheel that just getting going is going to take you months and months. And it's going to start yielding rewards maybe, let's say, 3, 6, 9 months down the line. But the longer you push it, the faster it's going to go. And so SEO is that thing where, boy, you're going to see nothing for maybe 6 months. And obviously, there's ways to hack around that and stuff. But, you know, I'm just setting some expectations. It's like, don't expect a bunch of results right away. But if you start seeing results, then you just build on those and build on those, and then they last for a long time. And as you said, the unsustainable are those, you know, kind of one-time activities that I do actually think. So you have questions on Quora and the unsustainable. I've seen some folks take an approach where, you know, those get upvoted and they wind up being popular and they get a lot of SEO traffic over time. So it depends on kind of how you do it. I think there are still some questions I've answered on Quora that continue to kind of get upvotes, you know, 2, 3 years later. And, you know, when you look at it, they've had thousands and thousands of views. So I think you need a mix of both. But as I said, I think it was last episode, in answer to Craig Hewitt's question, the one-time things are the things I would do early on because they get you the big boost. They're one time and they're quick. And so doing that joint webinar, if that gets you 10, 20 paying customers, you might not see 20 paying customers from SEO for, like I said, 6 months or more. And right now, what you need is revenue. You need customers and you need people paying you. And once you have the people paying you, then you can use that money then to kind of parlay up and reinvest it back into more joint webinars, or you can, you know, invest in SEO content marketing, et cetera.
When I mentioned answering questions on Quora, it wasn't so much that like your traffic was sustainable. It was that like you can't answer the same question on Quora more than once, or it's a burstable thing where you might answer 10 or 15 or 20 different questions, and then you wouldn't continue looking for more questions because there aren't more questions to answer. You basically have to wait a while. So that's really what I meant by classifying it as unsustainable. Not that the ongoing benefit from it is not sustained, but like the activity that you do around it is like just that one time, or you do it a couple of times and that's it. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, totally.
And again, like I think as Rob kind of pointed out, some of these things will cross over from one side to the other. It's not very much black and white. Like some things will cross over from one type to the next. And that leads us over into inbound versus outbound. And the way I kind of separate or classify things as inbound or outbound is inbound is functions on the basis of attracting people versus outbound activities and marketing channels. They function on the basis of actively and proactively going out and contacting people. So inbound would be things like the SEO, content marketing, where you're publishing things and you're trying to attract people to your platform or your blog or email newsletter, things like that, versus outbound, which is you're actively doing cold calling, sending out cold emails, doing outbound email prospecting on LinkedIn, or doing paid advertisements. And paid ads is kind of a mixed bag as well, because that kind of flips across a couple of different categories of these channels. But that's the main differences between inbound versus outbound. And when you're early on and if your timeline is short, you want to focus mostly on the outbound efforts. And the reason for that is because you need a lot more control over the activity. You want to be able to tie the activity that you're doing to the number of people coming in, because waiting for customers to come to you is not going to be enough. You could wait for months or years and you may still not get the number of customers that you need, versus doing those outbound activities where you can essentially drive the conversation and you can go actively get in front of those people as opposed to waiting for them to come to you.
I agree. I think that outbound has become more and more prominent in SaaS. I think it's become more prominent as kind of the enterprise players or enterprise software has, you know, come in. I mean, if you think back 10 years, there were very, very few enterprise SaaS or even mid-market SaaS companies that were targeting mid-market and enterprise companies. And in those fields, there's a lot of outbound, right? There's a lot of outbound cold calling is what it's traditionally been. And I think as, you know, when SaaS was mostly focused on the Fortune 5 million, as 37signal says, it really was it's so much more about creating content. I mean, it's the Joel Spolsky approach. It's the Basecamp approach. And those were the models that I think we saw. And those are the models that certainly resonated with me coming over as a developer. I didn't want to do the cold calls and the cold emails and the outbound stuff. So I see a lot of value in both, to be honest. Probably not cold calls myself these days, but I think there is, even if you're bootstrapped, I think getting over I don't know, kind of the mental stigma of not doing outbound, I think is something that you're going to want to at least wrestle with internally and not just focus on the SEO and the split testing and the content marketing. I mean, those are the things that I was blogging about in 2007, 2008, and they do still work, but they're not nearly as easy because there's so much more competition. Right. So if you want to get somewhere faster, then I do think you're going to need a mix of inbound and outbound. And, you know, again, going back to Hittail, I did no outbound except for kind of JV. There were JV emails that I would do with folks. But with Drip, we absolutely did outbound cold emails. And we did a lot of paid advertising, both for Hittail and Drip.
And once you've kind of established a revenue base or gotten to your initial goals, you can kind of switch over a little bit. Or if your timeline is long enough because you've got a lot of runway to work with, or you love your full-time job and you don't want to quit, but you like doing something on the side, then it's easier to wait for those longer-term strategies to pan out. And it basically gives you more options when you've got a longer runway or you've got a longer timeline. So at that point, things like content marketing make a lot more sense because, you know, you can decouple the customer acquisition rate from the activities that you're doing. You can do link building, you can create content, you can create videos for YouTube, all those different things because you have the time to spare. But if you are in a position where you want to find out quickly whether or not this is going to go anywhere, you need to push on those things and you need to do those outbound efforts in order to verify quickly versus waiting, because you could wait for a very long time to find out and you'll almost never know for sure. But obviously, if somebody post the link on Reddit or something like that, and you get 10,000 customers, yeah, that's a pretty good stamp of approval. But the chances of that happening are so minute that it's not realistic to even think about depending on those things. So I think with the things that we've talked about so far, the next question that comes to mind is, okay, all of this sounds great, but where do I actually start? So we've kind of talked around the issue, and I think to kind of address it head on, the first place that I would start is looking at your personal network and seeing if there's anyone in that personal network who can help you. And the prime example that I think I would point people to in most cases is go to your LinkedIn profile and see who you're connected to and who you've worked with in the past, or, you know, go to your Twitter profile and see who you follow or who follows you and find those people and contact them and say, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm working on. Is there a use for this either in your business or do you know somebody who it could be useful for? And there's ways to go about it without seeming overly salesy. I mean, you can definitely just say, hey, I'm working on this. Can you take a look at it and give me some advice? Or, you know, I'd like a little bit of help. What do you think that I should do? Those are great places to start the conversations because it's asking somebody for help versus, hey, you know, can I sell this to you? And it's a much better starting point for a conversation, especially if you don't have a good working relationship with that person or you haven't met them in person before, because then it opens the door for them to put themselves in a position of quote unquote expert where they're giving you advice. And people love to give advice on like whatever your new product is. No matter what you've built, people will always want to give you advice on it. And it doesn't mean that it's good or bad or that it's going to be exactly what you should be doing, but it's at least a starting point for a conversation. And from there, you can branch out, find out who they know, see if there's channels that they can promote it through, or if they're just interested in it. I mean, because some types of products are going to resonate very, very well with certain people. And they may say, hey, I can't personally use this, but I have an audience that I cater to, and they would love to take a look at this. So can we take a look at it and do a deep dive or get on a call and talk about it a little bit more, or maybe go through a demo? And that gives them a little bit more material to work with than you just sending them a cold email saying, hey, I would like you to take a look at this and I think it might help your business. Those conversations and discussions are going to get you a lot farther if you have some sort of context with the person and try to help them to understand what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think that if I was starting out today, some of the approaches that I would focus on early on would be, I would definitely be looking at paid acquisition. I'd be looking, depending on your product, you know, it's going to be Facebook or Instagram or LinkedIn or Twitter. Probably AdWords is probably not going to work because it's just too expensive these days. And, you know, it depends on how much you want to get in to run the ads. I know some people just are averse to it. And I had someone, you know, doing some marketing for me at one point. I was kind of mentoring and teaching him in it. And he said, is there anything I can do aside from running ads? Like, he just really didn't want to learn that. And so it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting opinion and perspective. Some people want to do it more the viral approach or with content. So you have to figure out, you know, what you're going to enjoy. And if you have budget to hire somebody, that's great, because folks who know how to run ads are going to be way, way, way better at it than you. But if you have to suck it up and you don't have any, you know, you don't have any money to hire someone, then obviously that's going to be an option. The thing I like about paid acquisition, man, is even in the early days, if it's not profitable, at least you're getting people in there to try it out and you get some kind of feedback. Another thing I would consider right off the bat, of course, is an email newsletter. I mean, that's email has just been a critical part for everything I've ever done, including MicroConf and my blog and selling books and selling software and, you know, getting people to use SaaS. I mean, it's just such an asset to have. I don't know these days that I would start a blog. If I were going to try to market a new SaaS app, I would look at, if I was going to do content marketing, I would probably take, you know, a different approach to it. I would at least debate whether the resources that I would need and the ongoing publication and the ongoing article cost would not be better spent doing more, I don't know, bigger products, like not even products, but kind of bigger content efforts. We did this with Drip. We started getting success. We had an ebook, and then I did an audio version of that ebook, and it was, you know, about kind of email marketing automation. I think it was getting started with it. And then I can't remember what else. I think we did maybe a video course, and we like submitted it to Product Hunt, and we put it on Gumroad, and we sold a bunch of copies, but we gave it away for like the first few days, and it got a bunch of traction through those. And so they were more one-time bursts, but they did help longer term with SEO because we get so many backlinks from these things. So it's an interesting thing to think about, you know, instead of publishing content constantly, is it an option to do less frequent content, but just try to make a bigger splash? And this is part of the thing that you see, let's say Neil Patel or some of the other kind of big blogger content marketers moving in that direction, right? Writing, even if they aren't doing ebooks or packaged products that they're giving away, they're doing just longer form stuff. And so it's less content or fewer posts, but they're a lot longer form. And of course, then that leads you to SEO. And if you know how to do SEO and you're good at it, by all means do it. If you're trying to learn it from scratch today, it's going to take a while. I'm not saying don't do it, but it is much harder than it used to be. And, you know, it's going to be a big road up there. But if you can get SEO, content marketing, email newsletter, and paid acquisition, if you can get two of those working, you're gonna have a pretty nice growth engine. And of course, during this time, I would be, because those things are not, I mean, you can spend a lot of time doing those, but I loved just having, in the early days of Drip especially, I just had alerts on Quora. And when stuff would come up in the email marketing category or startup category, I'd try to jump in and answer those. I'm a big fan of podcast tours. I've done them for years. And if you can pull one off, I think there's a lot of value there. It's for not a lot of time investment. And then of course, joint webinars, if you do have the network, you know, it all depends on what kind of what your unique, I think, asset is. And if you have, you know, if you're really good at SEO, then go after that. If you're good at paid acquisition, then go after that. And if you have a good network, then you can work that, right, to get people to email you. And if you have none of these, which, you know, one day back in the day, like all of us had none of those, you have to pick one. You have to start from scratch. You have to hustle. And that's the thing, is it's never going to be as hard as this first app when you're starting it with no revenue, no customer base, no network, no audience. It's like, that's when it's going to be the hardest. So that's when you have to push the hardest. It's only going to get easier from then on.
Something else I'd mention is, like, that kind of goes along with what you said, was that in those early days when you're trying to get the product out the door and you're getting it in the hands of people, there's almost no substitute for getting directly in front of somebody and talking to them about your product and what it is that you're trying to achieve and how it solves the problem that you went after. There's a lot of credibility and trust that goes into signing up for a SaaS app these days. And you can overcome a lot of objections just by having a conversation with somebody. So whether it's a phone call or, you know, a webinar or a one-on-one demo through like a Zoom account or Skype or something like that, you can overcome a lot of trust issues just by having that one-on-one conversation with somebody and answering their questions. Your website doesn't need to look fantastic. You don't have to have a great onboarding experience. You can hand walk somebody through your onboarding and talk them through every single question that they have. And the information that you're going to get from them about what concerns they have or just the questions that they ask are going to be very valuable to you and being able to come up with answers that will not only answer them, but also answer everyone after them who is going to have the same types of questions. So if they ask, how do I use this piece over here? You know that that's probably going to come up for other customers. Or if they say, what is this button over on the bottom right here do? If it's got a weird icon, they may say something to you. And if they do, then you can use that to make the product better and hopefully reduce the number of questions, which ultimately reduces the friction, which helps people move through the sales pipeline a little bit better. And yes, it's tedious. It takes a long time to get through that, but the insights that you're going to get from that are massive, and it just helps you move things along. And it is slow. It's a slow process, but it does work over the long term. You just have to kind of walk through every single step of it.
I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number, 888-801-9690, or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.